everyone. Thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2019, and you're listening to episode 134, which is a discussion about the argument for abortion to be legal even if the fetus is a person. On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts, who is the founder and president of Merrily Human Ministries, Inc., an organization committed to equipping Christians and people who hold pro-life views to graciously defend the intrinsic dignity of all human life in a positive and gospel-focused manner. Jay has written an online exclusive book review for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called "Are Laws Restricting Abortion Forced Organ Donation? Reviewing David Boonen's Beyond Roe, Why Abortion Should Be Legal Even If the Fetus is a Person." And you can read this book review for free online at our website, equip.org. Jay, it's good to have you on.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, the abortion debate is certainly not lessening almost 50 years after Roe v. Wade. In a sense, it's kind of, you know, as we enter into the big presidential election of 2020, unfortunately, this particular issue has been in the last, I don't know, almost 45 years or so, been tied to politics. And so it's kind of ramping up. And I've noticed on major newspaper websites that they're featuring articles about abortion every single day. I mean, I just saw one today about someone who's pregnant arguing for being able to have an abortion because her child would die shortly after the birth. And so basically, there's stuff coming out about it all the time. And I think for people who hold to the pro-life view, for Christians who hold to this view, one of the main things that we always talk about when we have this discussion is to argue that the fetus is human. And then that's a really big issue. So this kind of is intriguing that a brand new book has come out by a pro-choice advocate who is, okay, let's say the fetus is a person. Why should abortion be legal? And I want our listeners to know that over the years, going back all the way to the early 90s, we have published some articles on something called the bodily autonomy argument that was a proponent by this woman named Judith Jarvis Thompson, I believe. And I just want to, before we kind of get into it, because some people haven't been following this, and you know, our listeners can go to our website and we have a variety of in-depth articles on this particular bodily autonomy argument. But why don't you tell our listeners, what is that argument?
Well, you hit it on the head initially where you said, generally speaking, the majority of discussion about abortion, when you have people, pro-life advocates versus those who argue in favor of abortion rights, the argument centers on the idea that the fetus is not like us. One of the things I tell audiences, we have two categories of arguments. One of them is that it's not one of us. The other one category would be one of us, but it's when they argue it's not one of us, they're saying that there's something different about a fetus, about an embryo, about nascent human life, that the obligations and duties that we have to other human lives, we don't have to them. They draw a line through the human continuum of development, and they say that everybody after this point, whatever point they point us to, everyone after this point on the line, they are a person, someone like us, someone valuable. But everybody on the other side of the line, they're not the kind of things to which we have moral obligations or duties to. They're not one of us. And what bodily autonomy arguments do, and it goes back to Judith Jarvis Thompson from MIT, her article, A Defense of Abortion, in 1971, she wrote an article where she said, what if I stipulate, for the sake of argument, that the unborn is human in every way that the pro-life advocate says that they are fully human, that we have the same duty and responsibilities to them that we would have to anyone else. Said, even if I stipulate that, she tried to make a philosophical case that under those terms, abortion should still be morally acceptable. Her argument was a moral argument because what she said through a series of increasingly interesting analogies, starting with her most famous, the violinist, but going on from building from there, what she said was that even though a woman is pregnant, is carrying a morally valuable human being, no human being has the responsibility, duty, or obligation to another human being to lend them their body or their organs. And so a pregnant woman would be doing what she called the Good Samaritan argument. What most is commonly called the violinist in her argument is called the Good Samaritan argument. She says that a woman who allowed her child to gestate within her, who chose to carry the child to birth would be a good Samaritan, would be doing a morally laudable act, a supererogatory act, something that should be celebrated. But if she chooses not to, Judith Jarvis Thompson called her a minimally decent Samaritan. So at this point, she just is choosing not to do this heroic thing. She's choosing to be her basic moral duties to herself. And so Judith Jarvis Thompson's bodily autonomy arguments that started there were a moral argument that said, even if I grant the humanity of the unborn, no other human being has a moral obligation or duty to allow another human being to have access to their organs or their body to use for their purposes against the will of that individual. And so she says it's morally permissible to get an abortion, even if the unborn are human. So why that's a big deal is because the overwhelming majority of arguments that the pro-lifers make are pointing to the idea that the unborn are human. And Judith Jarvis Thompson steps in and says, even if you win that argument, you don't win the abortion argument on a moral level, because you can't force a woman to operate against her own will or own interest by letting someone use her organs.
You know what I find very interesting for pro-abortion advocates, or just like, you know, the average layperson type of, you know, person that you're engaging in discussion, is they don't ever cite her argument. They never talk about the bodily autonomy argument at all. And so I find it really interesting because, you know, when you're somebody who's pro-life, you're bringing up the humanity of the unborn. And most of the time, those arguments are not the conventional ones that you hear from, you know, just average folks.
And I think that's because the majority of people, it's been my experience, and I think we have some data to support this when you see how polling goes as far as support for abortion versus support for Roe v. Wade. I believe the majority of people haven't thought deeply about it. What they've done is they've landed on a position and they have stayed there. And so that's why you get these weird polls where they say the majority of people say they support Roe v. Wade consistently, somewhere about 60 to 70%, or at least that has been the case for the last couple of decades. And then the majority of people want restriction on abortion. They say, well, it should be restricted. You know, it should be an early in pregnancy thing. Well, you can't have a majority on both of those unless a significant percentage in there just don't understand what Roe v. Wade says. And so there, I think what you're seeing is that most people don't have a considered position on abortion. They have a knee-jerk position, or they have a position maybe they inherited from their culture or the place where they grew up or their parents or their circle of friends. And I think that plays out in conversations. It's only when you get to the really sophisticated people like David Boone and Judith Jarvis Thompson, or people that you meet who are deeply advocating one side or another, that you tend to find people who go to the violinist. I have heard anecdotally from many friends that they're hearing some form of the violinist or Boonen's argument that we're going to be talking about today much more conversationally with college students on campuses nowadays, though.
Oh, that is really fascinating. I want to tell our listeners that one of the articles on this topic that we have free online on our website is specifically called Suffer the Violinist, Why the Pro-Abortion Argument from Bodily Autonomy Fails. So you can look up that one too to give you some more background on particularly this argument by pro-abortion advocates. So how does this particular book by David Boonen build on, you know, Judith Jarvis Thompson's original arguments?
Yeah, Boonen is, by my estimation, one of the two or three greatest pro-choice advocates on a philosophical level. And I mean that from a position of respect. When I read David Boonen's work, I come away with a better understanding of the issue. And he has always been a champion, primarily, of Thompson's violinist argument and bodily autonomy arguments. That's his main passion, is defending it. He thinks it has power. Now, what he does in Beyond Roe is that he pivots from Thompson and the violinist and goes to a fairly obscure court case, which was McFall v. Shrimp, where in this he says, what we're going to do is we're going to look at a court case where a man got aplastic anemia from his job, and he had a cousin, Shrimp, who was looked like maybe a good donor for him, but Shemp then refused to be a bone marrow donor, refused to do any of the testing to consider doing it, and McFall tried to sue him. And when he failed to win that case, what happened was David Boone, the judge says, look, I think that Shemp should have helped his cousin, and I condemn him morally, but I can't legally force him. Nobody should be legally forced or compelled to be a donor to somebody else in this manner. That would just go against all of our concepts of freedom and our will to do with our body as we wish. So what Boonin does from this is he pivots from the moral argument that Thompson was making, that there's nothing wrong with a woman refusing to gestate her child, as they would use, the language they would like to use. And he says, even if it's wrong, we can now grant the humanity of the unborn every way that the pro-life advocate wants us to. We can grant in every way that the pro-life advocate wants us to that it's an immoral act, but it should still be legal. Because if you think that the judge decided correctly that McFaul had no right to Shep's bone marrow, then you think you should, by extension, believe that even if we condemn the woman's actions as immoral for not being willing to carry her child to term, that the child, as human as McFaul was, as human as the violinist is in Thompson's argument, that the child, the unborn, the fetus, it does not have a right to the woman's body, her kidneys, her liver function, anything as well. She can't be forced to gestate. That's not a position the state holds. So his building on it is by now granting the two major premises of the pro-life argument, that it is human and that the act of abortion is immoral. And he says, even so, we have good legal reasons to believe that it ought to be legal. And he appeals to an intuition here, a strong intuition, where he says, you yourself, most people out there believe probably that judge decided correctly. We all think Shemp should have donated his bone marrow, but we all think the judge was right. That intuition leads us to a position for the legality of abortion, even if we think abortion is immoral.
So if Boonin thinks that abortion should be legal, even if it's immoral, would he include women getting abortions for reasons like sex selection? I'd rather have a boy or girl.
Yes, absolutely. Because the morality has been lifted from it, the restrictions on the motivations of the woman are completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter if it's an important thing. You know, like we hear that a lot from pro-choice advocates where they say, this is not anything that a woman enters into lightly. This is a serious matter. There are grave issues that surround it. Boonin will concede, yeah, sure, that happens. But we also have to be honest that there are superficial abortions out there. There are women that get them for ridiculously superficial, or they're evil in the sense of, or he wouldn't use the term evil, but he would say wrong, right? You should not abort a child because it's a girl and you wanted a boy, or vice versa. But he'll say all of those motivations are immaterial because we've already all agreed that the act of abortion itself may be immoral. And then including in that, whatever motivations she has. So if she wants to get an abortion, simply because she's going on a vacation next week and she doesn't want to be pregnant on the vacation, maybe restrict her drinking or her ability to do other things, that's fine. That's the way it should be. She should have that right because we agree that no woman should be legally compelled by the state to allow her body to be used by somebody else.
You're listening to the Most Modern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Jay Watts, and he has written a book review of the new book from David Boonin called Beyond Roe, Why Abortion Should Be Legal, Even If the Fetus Is a Person. And you can read his review free online at our website, equip.org. You know, it's really vital that you help us to continue to provide all this great equipping free online content, which is in the form of this podcast, Postmodern Realities, and all of our online exclusive feature articles, book reviews like this one, and film and television series reviews. And you can do that in two different ways. One is to partner with us by purchasing a print subscription. A subscription is $33.50, and you can subscribe to our magazine at our website, equip.org. And then another way that you can support this podcast, our journal, and all of the Christian Research Institute outreaches like the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff and his podcast, Hank Unplugged, is you can now tip us when you read our articles or listen to our podcasts. So you're going to find a link where you can tip us at our website at the landing page for this discussion about David Boonin's book, Beyond Roe. And when you go to our website, click magazine, go to the drop-down menu, PMR podcast, click on that, and find the landing page for this episode. And there's a link there. And if you enjoy our content and you want to keep it free, please give us a tip and consider that for like $3 or $5 or $10, maybe the equivalent of a couple of weeks of your favorite coffee drink. And we would really appreciate it. And we're very thankful for all of our listeners and the people who come to our website and all of our subscribers. And we do want to continue to bring this very interesting content, and I enjoy talking to all of our journal authors, and they have some really unique and helpful and informative and equipping insights on a wide variety of topics that applies to Christian apologetics. And so we want to continue to bring this to you free. So maybe a subscription isn't in your budget this month. Please consider a small tip of $3 or $5. Or if you already subscribe and you've even given a gift subscription, you can still continue to help partner with us and specifically the Christian Research Journal and all of our content by giving us a tip. And thank you. We were just talking about Boonin's argument that even if, you know, abortion is immoral, it should be legal, even in the case of things like sex selection, or you gave the example of, you know, I'm going on a vacation and I want to be able to, you know, drink alcohol and I don't want to be pregnant. Are there any limits that he would think of regarding abortion that could be justified under his argument? Are there any limits to when abortion can be justified under this argument at all?
Under his, on this argument, he would put a limit at viability. Now, David Boonin, in general, wouldn't, as far as philosophically, if you were talking to him. But as the argument that he's constructed here, which is a legal argument, he would put a limit on viability. And his reason for putting a limit on viability is he weighs heavily, obviously, on the McFaul v. Shemp case. And he points back to the idea of, if we were talking about viability, he says, I liken that to the idea that Shemp allowed McFaul to use his organs all the way up into the point that McFaul didn't need it anymore to live. It may have helped him to continue to do it, but he wouldn't have done it and then wanted to kill him. You know, that he was, I agreed for a time to let you do it so that you got healthy to the point where you could probably live on your own, that you no longer needed my bone marrow, that we no longer needed. And he imagines this bone marrow sharing machine as part of his analogy here. He said, if Shemp allowed him to use it to the point where McFaul could probably exist on his own and then wanted to kill McFaul as a result and kill him for that, then he says that would be wrong. It says, so by translation, viability would be wrong. He also extends it to solve like an infanticide issue as well. He says, you can't, you know, as someone like Peter Singer or Michael Tooley or others would argue that there's no moral difference between the unborn immediately before they're born and a newborn. They're the same thing. Where you are doesn't make you valuable. It's what you are that makes you valuable. And since they put conscious awareness as their highest value, they would say, well, infanticide's okay. Well, in the same way, he'd say, no, infanticide can't be okay or a justification under this argument, because that would be like Shemp giving his bone marrow to McFaul and then deciding after he became healthy that he didn't want a cousin at all and trying to kill him after the fact. And so he does have limits, and those limits are on when at such point the child no longer necessarily needs the mother's organs to survive.
So beyond the fact that this position offers a legal justification for abortion, even if it is immoral, as he's saying, does Boonin see any other advantages to this argument for the pro-choice position?
Yeah, for the legal side, he says this solves a problem where you have a lot of people talk about cognitive dissonance or trying to point out irregularities or discrepancies or contradictions in the law. And one of the strongest ones is you often hear people discuss feticide laws, laws where if you take an action against another human being who's pregnant and you cause the death of her fetus, you are going to be punished in extension for what you did to her and what you did for her unborn child. And this is an area for the abortion rights advocate that they struggle with because it looks inconsistent. So there appears to be an inconsistency there. And so what Boonin says is this solves that problem altogether, right? Because there is no inconsistency in recognizing that if a woman is choosing to gestate that child is valuable whether or not she decides to do what she wants to do with her organs. Someone external to her has no right to attack that child, to attack the unborn, to attack the fetus. No one outside of her has the right to attack that because that would be an action of hostility against a valuable human being, something that ought to be protected under the law, except in his case, the most extreme case where you're forcing another human being to loan him the organs. And so he says, look, this takes care of that. This takes that off the table right now. It's no longer an inconsistency. There's no dissonance. There's no problem here whatsoever.
So how does Boonin deal with the objection that, you know, women consent to sex? Well, you know, in most cases that we're talking about, I mean, obviously, you know, there's some other issues, but, you know, in most of the circumstances where people are seeking abortion, there's been a consent to sex. So, and that is bringing the needy person into existence in you know, in the womb. And so while in the violinist, in the bodily autonomy argument, there is no responsibility for the condition of the gravely ill individual, how does he deal with this whole issue of consent?
Yeah, the idea of consent to him, it's an interesting chapter. He has, the book is broken down into three major areas, really, where he sets the case for the argument, and then he deals with objections, and then he deals with the restrictions that he believes that ought to be lifted as a result of embracing his idea of the law here. And when he talks about consent, he has a whole chapter, and it's written at a lay level. Its intent is to speak to not the sophisticated people on either side, but for those who are trying to understand what the arguments are, and specifically what these bodily autonomy and legal arguments he's making are. And here he gets, I think, odd. and because he says, in one of them, he says, it is not a popular convention nowadays that consenting to sex is consenting to pregnancy. And so, since the regular convention is that there are other things that we could do as sex, the sex can be for having fun, for release of stress, or whatever you want to call it for. There is no popular convention, whether or not it's a natural convention. He dismisses the idea of the natural nature of pregnancy altogether later on in the book. But the popular convention, he says, is not there. And so he likens it to several different things. He says, if you go to a casino and you bet on black at a roulette wheel, there is a popular convention that you have consented to have that money given up if you lose. He said, if you get into a car, a taxi, and you tell them to drive you to X place, the popular convention is that by asking them to do that, you have consented to pay them the money that they deserve for what they've done. But he said, in this particular case, there is no popular convention any longer that sex, a natural consequence of sex, is pregnancy. There are means by which people are trying to frustrate their reproductive systems, and those are naturally understood to be mostly effective. And so it's not a natural, conventionally understood thing that consent to sex is consent to pregnancy. Now, whether that is reasonable or not is tabled. He doesn't really cover that. I think it's an unreasonable expectation, obviously, that you can separate a reproductive act from reproductive results. And we know it's reproductive because they call these things reproductive health and they call it birth control. And everything about how we talk about this is in recognition that it's reproductive, but he doesn't really go into that too much. And then he likens it to accidentally finding yourself. Like I said, let's say he goes with the intent, Shemp goes to visit McFall with the intent to consider or in some way visit him to lift his spirits. And he slips and falls into a machine that suddenly is donating his marrow to McFall. He said, you know, walking across the room was not consent to the results or the consequences of slipping and falling into the machine. And so simply because he consented to walk across the room doesn't mean that he consented to slip, fall into this bone marrow machine, and now must allow McFall to continue to use his bone marrow. Of course, he has to completely separate any natural understanding of what the reproductive is act from reproductive results or consequences in order to get there, because all of these things, cabs, roulette wheels, he even mentions going to a restaurant and ordering lasagna or falling into a bone marrow, is in no way directly related with each other when you're talking about a reproductive act by its very nature having reproductive results. In all of the language that he and anyone else would ever use to discuss this without doing verbal linguistics and gymnastics to avoid acknowledging the fact, recognizes between birth control, reproductive health, all of it, that this at some level or another component to this is making babies.
So what about natural parental obligation? Does Boonin see any natural parental obligation to balance out the right to refuse the use of the pregnant woman's organs?
Yeah, what he does is he takes parental obligations and he breaks it into two categories. He takes what we call the biological parental obligation, that I have obligations and duties and responsibilities natural to my children, to my offspring, that I don't have to other people. And to sort of undermine that, he also brings in what he would call social parental responsibilities, adoptive parents, foster parents, the ability of the state to step in and take responsibility or duties. And he says, in both of these cases, they don't do enough to override the idea that we would have no responsibility. And of course, he goes back to McFall v. Shemp, and he says, well, imagine then that McFall is a long-lost child through maybe in vitro or something of Shemp, and he finds this out. Does he now have a responsibility to allow McFall to use his bone marrow? And he says, if you think not, and this is where it gets very interesting, I think. There is a there's a assumption through this that by taking everything apart bit by bit, he somehow undermines the natural relationship that mothers have to their children or the fathers have to their children. I talk to the audiences all the time. I said, look, if I'm here speaking, I was speaking in DC just this last weekend. I told the audience, if I leave here, and there was a young woman in the back named Mary, and you call me up and ask me where Mary is when I get home, and I tell you, I have no idea. I have no responsibility for Mary. I just met her while I was here. It'll be naturally understood that I have no duty or responsibility to have account for the whereabouts of Mary. Had my 10-year-old child, Nika, been with me, and I left her there in a chair and then flew home, and you called me up and you said, hey, Jay, you left Nika here, there should be legitimate moral condemnation and punishment for me as being failing my basic parental responsibilities to my daughter. And if I responded, hey, Nika's 10, she can figure it out, she'll get home all right, everybody would recognize that I'd done something grossly immoral and illegal. I mean, there's both of those things, and I would get into trouble for it. He's unbothered by this because he keeps twisting McFaul v. Shimp to come to a place where you would say, no matter how he twists it so that he can and put into it some level of parental relationship, whether or not it be adoptive or natural, if you still don't think Shipp should be forced to give his bone marrow to McFaul, then you have to deny that parental obligation by itself is enough to require a woman to carry her child. But nobody would ever argue to isolate parental obligation in itself. They would argue that parental obligation is a part of a very complicated relationship that goes on between a pregnant mother and her unborn child. And he sort of weakens all of them by trying to isolate them and making it sound perfectly reasonable to deny any one of them without ever dealing with the whole in general.
So how does Boonen answer the objection that, you know, by the court ruling in Shimp's favor and letting McFaul die, is that different from intentionally destroying the life of a fetus?
Here he does, and this goes also, this is also back to Judith Jarvis Thompson's violinist arguments, which we've mentioned several times, which imagines that you're sewn up to a world-class violinist against your will so that he can use your kidneys for 9 months and then they'll let you go. Thompson says you have no moral obligation to allow him to use your kidneys. Boonen says McFaul has no moral right to Shimp's bone marrow. But in both cases, one of the objections that people level back against this is that this isn't an analogous, because if the violinist dies, he dies of the kidney ailment that he brought to the relationship, the pathology that he carried into it. If you disconnect yourself from the violinist, you're not intentionally killing him, though you know it's letting him die of what he's ill of. In the same way, when McFaul did die very shortly after this court case was decided, Shimp, by letting him die, didn't intentionally kill him. What killed McFaul was aplastic anemia, and he had it prior to his request, prior to his lawsuit, and then after Shimp refused. And so Shimp's refusal to allow his body to be used is not the intentional killing McFaul. It is the letting McFaul die of his aplastic anemia without doing any or making any effort to save. So it was withholding of support. It was not an intentional destruction, where abortion is by very definition the intentional destruction of an innocent human life. It has to be. A life has to die for an abortion to succeed. And he says, well, what if we did just purely extraction abortions, right? Like a hysterotomy, where we make a small incision like we were doing a C-section, but smaller, and we pull the child out and allow the child to just die of its pathology that it brought to the relationship, just like the kidney ailment, just like the aplastic anemia. And in this case, the pathology is that it's not mature enough to survive on its own. And he says, if we're willing to concede that hysterotomy abortions are not the direct action against the child, but at that point, it's a failure to save under his definition, then we say some abortions should be legally on the table, because an extraction abortion isn't killing. It's just removing the child and letting it die. And so that's his defense of it. It's a defense that he comes under quite a lot of criticism from another pro-choice advocate, though, for that.
So does Boonen ever think that a reason why a woman would want an abortion ever has any bearing on the legality of that abortion?
Yeah, no. He is, in this particular case, morality has nothing to do with it. And since he sees no direct connection into killing, and I said in the review, we talked about Kate Greasley, who, again, if I would say Boonen is one of the two or three best pro-choice advocates on the planet, I would say Kate Greasley is too. And she is a lawyer. She teaches and is a lecturer in law. She's written a great book on this particular called Arguments About Abortion. And she devotes 3 or 4 chapters in there to taking apart bodily autonomy arguments, because she doesn't see them favorably, where she says, look, acts of omission is not what we're talking about. It's still the intentional destruction of life, even if it's killed by extraction. Since Bunin disconnects all moral responsibility or duty for the act of killing the child, now it's just a question of choosing to withhold support. So, well, if I choose to withhold support, if I choose not to gestate, why I choose to do so is irrelevant. And here's why, too, to add this. What he says is whatever additional motivations they may have, let's say he would say, like, let's say Shemp hated McFall and wanted McFall to die. And for any, you know, horrible reason that you can come up with, the most evil reasons that you can come up with, that is an extra thing involved in the idea that Shemp still has no obligation or duty to let McFall use his organs. And so he says in this place as well, even if they actively wanted the child to die, even if the mother wished the child to be dead, in the case of an extraction abortion like a hysterotomy, she isn't actively working towards his death. And then he does some interesting twists and turns in his argument to say that hysterotomy is then equal to all other abortions if you accept it, and that all abortions of all types should be legal. But he would say that because the main moral and legal focus here, specifically the legal focus, is the reason they're allowed to get it isn't because they want them dead. The reason they're allowed to get it is because no one should be compelled or forced to offer their body as an organ donor against their will. And so it simply doesn't matter whatever the motivations are for wanting the abortion, be it whatever, I mean, if it's racist, if it is hateful, if it's misogynistic, whatever it is, all of that is just extra to the legal right that they have, as long as we don't understand it is the intentional. But now Kate Greasley says you have there's no necessity to kill the child. So he's saying his problem is this doesn't raise to that level. There is no life in the balance here. The mother will not die. The legal necessity that is offered, she said you have to have necessity and proportional response if you're going to point towards a self-defense right here. If you're going to say I'm under attack, the baby's an aggressor, the unborn child is an aggressor on me, she says that's not the case. The unborn child's not an aggressor. The unborn child simply exists. It can't be an aggressor by virtue of existing. And the mother's life, in most cases, in some cases that would be different, but in almost all cases, the mother's life's not in danger. So there's no necessity to kill another valuable human being. And the response to having your organs borrowed, killing the other, isn't proportional. And then she goes on to say that the very idea that these extraction abortions are simply the omission of saving lives is ridiculous. She said it's obviously the intentional destruction of that human life. It's the whole goal. It's exactly what you wanted. It's the end result. It's what you were sought after when you got after it. So it gets excited. I think Bunin's brilliant, but I think under examination, and why I love Kate Greasley is because she's a pro-choice advocate doing this heavy lifting for us. Even she looks at it and says, this just does not raise to that kind of level that you're talking about. That level of justification just doesn't give you the right to kill another human being.
So what about the current abortion legal environment? Does Bunin think that it's too restrictive?
Yeah, amazingly he does, which I think is one of the crazy... Now that's because he comes from that point again, that once we accept that a woman should never be forced to donate her organs to another human being against her will, then any restriction on her uncoupling or ending her gestational obligations, these are the kind of terms that they like to use, that any effort to frustrate that or to make her feel badly about it is misplaced and should not be in the state's interest. The state shouldn't be involved in such a thing as that. And so even though we live in one of the most abortion permissive countries in the world, I mean, there's 7 countries in the entire world that have laws as permissive about abortion as the United States does. Some of those including like North Korea and China and Vietnam. I mean, not exactly places that we're oftentimes looking. Other ones, are Canada and other places. But we have some of the most permissive laws in the world, among 7 most permissive countries in the world as far as when we allow abortion. And Bunin looks at this and says, even that is way too restrictive. There ought to be no impediments, nothing that a woman should have access to it. It is her decision. Up to, of course, the legal argument at this point being viability. Now, he wouldn't believe that philosophically if you're discussing with him. I think he would push it back a little further based on his other works, his own book, Defense of Abortion. But in this under this argument that he offers in Beyond Roe, up to the point of viability, there should be 0 restrictions, no parental consent, no parental notification, no ultrasound laws, no nothing. It should be, women should be able to choose to do it.
It's not the focus of this conversation, but the whole parental consent thing is so quizzical to me because in certain states, you know, you cannot do certain things as a teenager without parental consent, but you don't have to have parental consent to get an abortion. And what's interesting is even, you know, abortion pro-choice advocates would say, yes, abortion is a medical procedure and yes, there are risks to it. And yet for even lesser types of procedures or things like, you know, tattoos or whatnot, you have to have parental consent.
Yeah. And one of the things, and I said this one time in a debate with a head of Planned Parenthood here in Atlanta on television at one of the local Atlanta news affiliates, we discussed this idea and I was explaining in that. You know, parents have to know if you have put the parent, if you've put the responsibility on the parent to take care of the health of that child, they need to know what's going on in the event of something as with the many things that could go wrong with an abortion, not all of them just being physical. They have to have some concept of what's going on. Right now, if I take my child to the doctor for a routine checkup, they give my child a depression test, right? They want to know if there are signs of depression there. They're looking for some sign that there is because of risk of suicide, because of risk of the dangers that depression has on them as they develop. In this particular case, you're on the opposite side now. The same people who would say those depression tests make sense will say, advocate for the position that my daughter at 14 ought to be able to go and get an abortion without my knowledge whatsoever, come home. And whatever emotional baggage she may be carrying from it, that's hers. You know, my 14-year-old daughter's got to sit back in her room and carry the emotional baggage of this without the knowledge of her parents, without us knowing anything that happened to her, without having any idea of what's causing all of this, to say nothing of health complications that could come as a result of it. And so it does seem counterintuitive that at one point we're very interested in what's going on in the lives of our kids by making them take these mandatory psychological tests. And at the other point, we want them to be free to make decisions that could have tremendous psychological impact on them or physical impact on them without any adult, responsible adult in their life knowing what happened. I think Robert George's, you know, response to this sort of thing where he says this is just madness makes the most sense there. It's madness.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Jace. So it's summertime. At a cookout, do you prefer burgers or hot dogs?
Oh, burgers. Double burger. I want them stacked too high with multiple layers of cheese on there.
Do you like a vacation away or a staycation?
Vacation away. Actually, just we have a supporter that allows us graciously to use this lovely beach house that they have every year. And so my family goes there. And it is peace to walk on the beach for me. Right, to be out on the waves, to be on wherever, in any way that I can get out there in the water and away from all of this and just be there. I take everything I love with me, even our dogs, they go with us. But to be away from all of this, to be there where it's just peace. So away, 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 away.
Well, I think that I know the answer after that to the next question, which is, on a vacation, do you prefer relaxing and doing nothing? Or are you the kind of person who likes to fill your days with lots of activities like hiking or visiting museums and exploring cities?
I love hiking. I mean, cities don't do much for me. I love hiking. I love being active. At the beach, we had two solid days where we had crazy great waves. And so I was out there for hours riding on the waves on boards. I love kayaking. I love getting out there and doing so. So I'm extremely active. I wake up early in the morning and go biking down the beach. If I'm up in the mountains, we get up and go hiking as often as I possibly can. When I was speaking in San Francisco, I make it up to Muir Woods every chance I get and spend time up there in the woods just walking. So I love being out in nature. Cities do nothing for me. I like art. I like museums, but as a whole, cities do very little for me. I'm much more of an outdoorsy kind of guy.
Do you have any hobbies?
Besides reading, which I guess a lot of people would just say, because I do love reading for pleasure, not just reading for work. I'm constantly astonished when I hear people in the apologetics or Christian community that are intellectuals say, I don't read novels. Like, how could you not read novels? I mean, they move me, change me, transform me in ways that other things don't. Also, lacrosse. My kids all play lacrosse. And so it's not uncommon for when I'm in town for us to get up early in the morning and go up to a local public field that we have up here and for us to just play lacrosse and do drills and to have fun coaching lacrosse when I'm in town and have a chance to help teams out locally that need a little help coaching. So lacrosse, I say, would probably be my hobby after reading and all the outdoorsy stuff. And I love just being out on the water, out hiking, running around, doing all that stuff.
Well, I think it's important for people to read novels because it's important to exercise your imagination.
Yes.
That's a good way to do it. Well, thanks, Jay, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities Podcast.
Always, always a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest has been Jay Watts, and we've been discussing his book review of David Boonen's new book, Beyond Roe, Why Abortion Should Be Legal Even If the Fetus is a Person. And you can read his review completely free online at our website, equip.org. We'd like to invite you to support this podcast and partner with us in two different ways. One is, if you're not already a subscriber to our print edition, please subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. Our quarterly magazine is $33.50, and you can subscribe at equip.org. And at Jay's review, you will find a link there where you can tip us. You can also tip us at the link at the landing page for this episode. And as a tip, you can give us a donation as small as $3 or $5 or $10 as your way of partnering with us and saying thank you if you are even already a print subscriber or if a print subscription is not in your budget this month. And again, to do either of those things, please visit our website, equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast.